Age by Shakespeare, Mistress Page in The Midwives of Windsor said, I cannot tell what the dickens his name is. And she's talking about the funniest of them all. Falstaff, yes. So now, we all know that, and that's new to me too. Charles Dickens is generally regarded as the greatest novelist, okay, the most popular novelist in English of the 19th century. He wrote 20 novels, and I know many of you can name them all, but some of the most famous are David Copperfield, Terror of Two Cities, Oliver Twist, Great Expectations, I first heard of him when I was in primary school. And I kept hearing friends of my parents saying things such as, let's say if we were at a braai, in the days when I used to go to such things, and a man would arrive and say, it is a far, far better thing that I do than I've ever done. Which of course made no sense to me whatsoever. And someone would get up, someone who could, whose English wasn't all that good, would say, when he was leaving something, after having a few drinks, he'd say, it is a far, far better, better, I am going to that, which meant nothing. And a lot of the people, men and women, kept on saying, it is the best of times, it is the worst of times, when referring to anything from a political situation to a case someone made. And I said to my parents, I don't understand. And my mother said, no, this all comes from a very, very famous novel by someone called Charles Dickens called A Tale of Two Cities, which I thought referred to Cape Town Durban. And I was quite amazed, I wouldn't remember, I was quite amazed when I was a bit older, because I knew that a lot of the men in particular who were quoting from Dickens, I knew they didn't read. I mean, I've got authors from picking this up over the years. So how come they knew it? It's been bothering me. I won't say I had any secrets nicer, but 2 weeks ago, I had this incredible inspiration. I almost jumped out the bath and said, Eureka, and I was in the bath. And I wonder, and I looked it up, and yes, they had just seen the 1958 movie, A Tale of Two Cities, with Dirk Bogarde, and that is what they were quoting all the time. Has anyone ever seen it? I haven't. I'm sure it's good with Dirk Bogarde. So, I always found it as interesting, but I became a real fan when I went to his house in Rochester, England. And then I was smitten 4 years ago when I went to Yonge Street in London to the Dickens Museum. And I saw it was his history, his books, his social conscience, everything he did for society. And also what an awful man he was at times, as well as marvelous. Has anyone else been to that house in London, Yonge Street? I'm sure you have. Really wonderful, isn't it? Marvelous. And my favourite novel of the lot is Great Expectations, but I think that is. So today we read Dickens for his fun, for his profundity, his social consciousness, his exposure of hypocrisy, his portrayal of evil. These inform all his works. And they make us realize that things might not have changed so much in the last 150 years. Often Dickens is looked at for all of his imagery, his structure, his themes. But today we're going to concentrate on three of his novels. His characters are hilarious at times, but we shouldn't take the frivolous characters too frivolously. Sometimes we laugh at people, as we don't hear say, because they're absurd in their despicability. Other times we laugh because we see through their hypocrisy. Sometimes, of course, we see our own society, our own neighbours, ourselves. Humour is used generally to entertain, to raise attention, or to reveal how ridiculous attitudes are in context. But we're going to an extract today where nothing of this appears. We laugh at the language of people, their accents, their pronunciation of the characters, and we laugh at what happens in a narrative as well. His lightness, Dickens's lightness, is most evident in his first novel, which is The Posthumous Papers of the Pickwick Club, commonly called The Pickwick Papers, which was published in monthly parts in 1836 and 1837, and it's something of a burlesque. And we're going to be ending with that one. And we're ending with that one because it is so light. Most critics concentrate on certain novels to portray Dickens' humour. There's a very good one, Dickens and the Rhetoric of Laughter, by James Kincaid, and he looks at the following. And I'm going to give you the initials. I wrote down the initials, and I must tell you, when I was going through everything last night again, I thought, oh my gosh, what does this stand for? So, we'll get in this together. I have to remember, by the way. PP would be, the writers looked at humour. They discussed humour occurring in PP, papers. OG, Oliver OCS, Bravo, OG, Oliver BR, Carnegie Garage, MC. Lots and shots of it. DC, obvious. David Copperfield. LD. Majority. And OMF. Our mutual friend. My God, this is impressive. The notes that Copper wrote in Charles Dickens' Humanly, Irony, and Language, they discussed BH, Bleak House, Pickwick Papers, of course, David Copperfield, Anthony. GE, Great Expectations. How many of you find Miss Havisham a humorous character? I don't know, I find it really sad. CC, Christmas Carol, yeah. A new one, NN. That actually came up before I said it. Okay. Oliver Twist, and again, O Curiosity Shop, and once more Martin Chuzzlewit. But we'll notice something, no hard times. It's not funny. It's Dickens' shortest major work, and F.R. Leavis, a great tradition, calls it Dickens's only serious work of art, which just goes to show you can't read everything you read. The Victorian critic, John Ruskin, said it was Dickens's greatest book. And I'm sure that everybody here will disagree, because you know his greatest book was David Copperfield. You know his greatest book was Great Expectations. You know his greatest book was In Hard Times, Sleary, the proprietor of the circus, lists, people must be amused. In the biography of Dickens, which came out recently, Claire Tomlin says that Hard Times is among the least popular of Dickens's novels because it fails to take note of its own message that people must be amused. So why are we looking at hard times today? Because it's not funny. It was his 10th novel, written in 1854, and you realize that now, its humor is usually neglected. The humor is often subversive, there is much irony, it is dark, it is full of pathos, and my gosh, it's funny. The novel is set in Coketown, which is a northern industrial city. The awful, wealthy Thomas Gradgrind rules his family and his school according to Jeremy Bentham's philosophy of utilitarianism, which has as its aim the greatest happiness for the greatest possible number of people, and something so is considered useful only in relation to all. Something is regarded worthy only in relation to its usefulness. In a sense, the form of utilitarianism which Dickens attacks in the novel is materialism. That denies all values other than material ones, or, as they are called in this novel, facts. In short, in very short, Thomas Gradgrind, the very wealthy, enforces the life of facts, the lack of fun and fancy on his children, the pleasant Louisa and the awful Tom. A destitute girl, a delightful sissy, is taken into the family when a circus performed for Louisa. Louisa, Gradgrind's daughter, eventually marries the awful so-called self-made man, Josiah Bounderby, who she eventually leaves and returns to Daddy, when she spurns the attempt to seduce her by the oh-so-sexy but awful James Harthouse, a young politician. Tom robs a bank, but blames it on the labourer, the marvellous Stephen Blackpool, who has an awful alcoholic wife, but is in love with Rachel, a wonderful factory girl. This is just because you haven't read it yet. You have to have noticed how most of the characters of the novel are either wonderful, wicked, or woeful. Eventually, Bounderby is found to be an awful liar. Tom escapes abroad when he dies, which is awfully appropriate. Blackpool also dies, which is awfully inappropriate. And Gradgrind realizes that Sissy was right all along. A life of the fancy, of senses and feeling is more important than a life of awful grind and gloom and facts. There's also humor in the name of the characters, Gradgrind, work, work, work. Bound to be, who is a? Exactly. Harthouse, who is a? Lover boy. And my favourite name of the lot in all of Dickens' writing, the teacher, Mr. Chokenchild. The names of the places are also amusing in a black humour way, Coketown. And the house of Gradgrind's stone lodge, nothing can change there. It's also appropriate that Gradgrind is a hardware merchant whilst it is coming to the surface. In short, the novel is about hard times. So what's funny about that? Nothing, most critics say. Let's just look at the opening chapters. And you have it in front of you, I think, right? Believe it or not, there is a link between hard times and the short serve we discussed yesterday. I didn't quote this part. Don't worry, it's not a scene. So, my taking of these two writers and two texts is not quite as random as it might appear, but I'll leave you in suspense. More about that later. So, now you've got it in front of you, let's look together. Chapter 1 starts, The One Thing Needful. Some of you will have recognized that this comes from the book of Luke, chapter 10, verse 42. I read it. Mary stayed at Jesus' feet and heard his words. That was needful. Jesus is passing the message. But this is the one thing needful, and the speaker is Thomas Radbrand. So we realize immediately that the speaker regards himself as somewhat messianic, somewhat of Messiah. He, in his philosophy, is going to save the world. He has an overblown impression of himself. He is full of hot air. So Dickens is preparing us immediately, even before the narrative starts, for something so important, vainglorious, and presumptuous. And if you don't get that from the heading of the chapter, you get it very soon. So let's see what it says. Now what I want is facts. Teach his ways and give us nothing but facts. Facts alone are wanted in life. Plug nothing else and root out everything else. You can only borrow the minds of reasoning animals upon facts. Nothing else can be of any service to them. This is a principle on which I bring up my own children, and this is a principle on which I bring up these children. Stick to facts, sir. He's talking to the children. So immediately you see what an incredibly charming man he is. But look at the metaphor. He regards children as commodities, as animals. But he misses out on the irony here. He speaks about reasoning animals. He brings up his own children this way. So Dickens is telling us, Gradline is an animal. You'll notice that facts is capitalized each time. And this is capitalized because, again, we'll see anaphora, repetition, for humor. We see this in the next extract as well. And also, it's truly important. It's very important. This is what it's about. Okay. The word fact, the origin was in the late 15th century. The original sense meant an act or a feat. In 1539, the meaning of fact had changed to mean a bad deed or a crime. Stick to the facts, sir. Its earliest use in the current sense, meaning truth or reality, only came about almost 50 years later, in 1581. And it seems that Dickens is using it in both its senses here. Fact meaning truth, but fact also meaning crime. It is criminal what this man is going to do. The sea was a plain, bare, monotonous vault of a schoolroom. And the speaker's square forefinger emphasized his observations by underscoring every sentence with a line on the schoolmaster's sleeve. You have it there? The emphasis was held by the speaker's square wall of the forehead, which had his eyebrows on his face, while his eyes found familiar, separated in two dark caves, overshadowed by a wall, not somebody you want to meet in a dark night in Cape Town. Look at him, and it's shown that he is a man of darkness, of ignorance, bored, separated, caves. I found the word commodious. Commodious means large, but it's also related to a commode, which is a chamber pot. And a commode for a chamber pot was first used in 1851. just before this novel was written. So I think that Dickens is pining here. He's enjoying himself. In other words, he's saying, from Herbert Semeridge, he's saying that Bradman is talking nonsense. The emphasis was held by the speaker's mouth, which was wide, thin, and hard set. The emphasis was held by the speaker's voice, which was inflexible, dry, and dictatorial. The emphasis was held by the speaker's hair, which bristled on the skirt of his bald head. I actually take exception to that. A plantation of fur to keep the wind from its shiny surface, all covered with knots, like a crust of a plum pie. As if their head had scarcely warehouse room for the hard fat scorn inside. And again, we see the wind from its shiny surface, in other words, full of hot air. This is caricature. Dickens at his best of a caricature. And we've got exaggeration, mockery, with the mixture of the letter back and the simile. So that's the beginning of the book. Let's skip to chapter 2, which is, I think, really, really funny. Murdering the innocents. Tells it all, doesn't it? But again, many of you will realize that murdering the innocents comes from? Well, what do you say? Really impressive. Matthew chapter 2, verse 16, Herod murdering the children. Thomas Radline seemed a kind of cannon, loaded to the muzzle with bats, and prepared to blow them clean out of the regions of childhood at one discharge. So, of course, we can discharge, obviously, cannonish, right, but it also makes us think of pus or something that's saturating. He seemed a galvanizing apparatus, too. I checked out the galvanized, stimulated by electricity, makes us think of something automatic, robotic, before robots came along, something mechanical. And the word was invented in the late 18th century, but it became more common in 1850 at about the time this book was written. So we get the idea that you regard children as just some shoes. You tell them to do something and they will do it. Charged with a grim mechanical substitute for the tender young imaginations that were to be stormed away. Gentlemen, number 20, said Mr. Gradbrand. Squarely pointing to his square forefinger. I don't know that girl. Who is that girl? A number, you see. Lizzie June, sir, exclaimed number 20, blushing, standing up, and cursing. Sissy is not a name, said Mr. Gradbrand. Don't call yourself Sissy. Call yourself Cecilia. Which, of course, is appropriate. We know that Cecilia was the patron saint of music, but there was a Cecilia in the 6th century who managed to convert her pagan brother to Christianity, just as Sissy Jupe manages to convert Thomas Gradgrind to decency. His father's called me Sissy, sir, returned the young girl in a trembling voice with another curtsy. That he had no business to do it. Businessman, said Mr. Gradbrand. Tell me, was it Cecilia Jupe? Let me see. What is your father?
He belongs to Constantine, please, sir.
Mr. Gradbrand frowned away off the objectionable call in his hand. We don't want to know anything about that here. You must tell us about that here. Your father breaks horses, don't he? Don't he? Yeah.
If he breaks, sir, but they can get anything ready. If you break horses in the ring, sir,
Your master tells us about the ring here. Again, very clever. The ring implying, of course, the horse ring. But we know the grand ride, everything is. He doesn't want to know about the ring. At all. It's anathema to him. Very well then, describe the father as a horse raker. He doctors the horses, I dare say.
Oh, yes, sir.
Very well then. He is a veterinary surgeon. A farrier and a horse raker. Okay, so he changes, you see in the beginning, he changes the facts to suit himself. Hypocrite. Give me your definition of a horse, since you trained the greatest alarm by this demand. Now, this is like a stage direction. Typical Dickens. It's in brackets. And what Dickens wants us to see, instead of saying, Sissy Duke blushes and she trembles and she cries and she looks down, just greatest alarm in brackets. In other words, our own imaginations can let us know how she reacts. Girl number 20, unable to find a horse, said Mr. Gradline, for the general Bahoo for all the little pigeons. Bahoo, the pun is obvious, isn't it? Meaning benefit, of course. Girl number 20 possesses no facts in reference to one of the commonest of animals. Some boy is a definition of a horse. Bitzer, yours. To Mrs. Stanford, quadruped, granulars, feet of grass. 40 teeth, maybe 24 grains. 480 and 12 incisive, sheds 14 in the spring, in marshy counties, sheds full stool, hoofs hard, but required to be shut with iron, age is fine, marshy mouth. That's a national audit, sir. So, again, Dickens is having an aside here, in brackets. In other words, he's saying, it's so boring. He might know the facts, but he knows nothing else. He might know what a horse is physically, but he might even know what a horse looks like. Now, girl number 20, said Mr. Gradline, you know what a horse is. But later, very well, said the gentleman, briskly smiling for his arms, some official. That's a horse. Now, let me ask you the other boys, would you take a room with representation of the horses? After a pause, one of the children cried in chorus, yes, sir. Upon which the other half, seeing the gentleman's figure, yes, it's wrong, cried out in chorus, no, sir! As the custom is in these examinations. How many of you are or have been teachers? Need I say more? Of course, no. Why wouldn't you? A pause. One corpulent stone with a wheezy manner of breathing, better the answer. Because he wouldn't pay for a room at all. Oh, you hate it. You must pay for it, said the gentleman rather warmly. You must pay for it, said Thomas Gradgrind. Whether you like it or not, don't tell us you wouldn't pay for it. What do you mean, boy? I'll explain to you then, said the gentleman, getting back to his original accent, after another and a dismal pause. Why you wouldn't pay for a room representation of horses? Do you ever see horses walking up and down the sides of a room in reality? In fact, do you? Yes, sir. From one half, no, sir. From the other. So, this is absolutely absurd, but it shows the stupidity of the question and how children will just answer what they think you want to hear. Of course, no, said the gentleman, giving the room to one half. Well, then, you're not going to see anywhere what you don't see, in fact. You're not having them, you're not having fact. You can notice that this gentleman is laughable because he keeps losing his accent. What is called taste is only another name for fact. Okay, taste and fact. Okay. I mean, how much Gladbrand on his activation? This is a new physical discovery, a great discovery, said the gentleman. Now I'll try you again. Suppose you get a carpet to room. Would you use a carpet having a representation of flowers upon it? Living in general conditions by this time, no, sir, no, sir. The cause of it's not known very strong. Only a few people, Stratton said yes, among them 52. Girl number 20, said the gentleman, smiling at half strength of knowledge, since his blushes to ground. So, you would have conquered your room, or your husband's room, if you were a grown woman and had a husband. Very sarcastic, Jan. With representations of flowers, would you? Said the gentleman. Why would you? If you please, sir, I'm getting one of the flowers, returned the girl. And is that why you would put tables and chairs upon them and have people walking over there with any boots? It wouldn't happen, sir. They wouldn't crush and wither. If you please, sir, you would leave pictures of what was very pretty and pleasant. And I would fancy. Aye, but you mustn't fancy, cried the gentleman, quite late after he said, I'm just waiting. That's it. You are never to fancy. Now here we have the link to Chaucer, to the Miller's Tale. You are never to fancy, because in the Miller's Tale, the miller of all people says, how fancy throws us into perturbation. People can die of mere imagination. And we know that the miller's always right. People can die of their imagination. So we've got this idea. So what Dickens is writing, there were characters long before who had something similar. The word fancy is a late Middle English word, 1465. It's a contraction of fantasy. And it comes from the Greek, meaning imagination and appearance, which means to make visible, appearance to make visible, the fantasy, fantasy, appearance to make visible. And we can relate this imagination, this fantasy of Circe, that actually saves the day at the end. However, fantasy also means to find attractive. But Brandwein finds facts attractive. So he fancies facts. Dickens is having fun here. And even if he wasn't aware of it, which he probably wasn't, we can certainly have fun planning all the words that he fancies facts. And that's a fact. This could also be summed up by the song Shakespeare's The Merchant of Venice. You might remember from last year, but Simon is examining the passage. Tell me where it's fancy, bread, or in the heart, or in the head. So one person's fancy is another person's fact. You are not Cecilia to Thomas Rampine solemnly repeated, to do anything of that kind. Fact, 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 said the gentleman. And fact, 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 repeated Thomas Rampine. I found it interesting in a time which we supplemented a few weeks ago, on the 30th of December, there was a review of the statesman's year of the politics, cultures, and economies of the world. The reviewer wrote, its origin to reflect the Victorian passion for facts and for reference books of all kinds. No doubt it would have appealed to Thomas Gradwine. So, comes out at all different times. So, what is actually humorous? Did you find it fun and humorous? Yeah. So, what is humorous here? Well, it's honest, absolutely nothing. Because of the bullying, pretentiousness, autocracy, and the lack of imagination, that is never funny. What is funny? Well, everything. Because of the bullying, pretentiousness, autocracy, and lack of imagination. Look at either way. It is made funny because of the context, the Victorian era. It is funny because we can relate it to South Africa, and also how they talked about all the time this outcomes-based education. Which, by the way, certain universities, that is how I can work out, Cambridge University, which I admire enormously, is not one of these universities. Certain universities stress what you can actually do to make money with a liberal arts degree, never mind how you can gain just like learning. We have mockery, the mentality of public servants is ridiculed, obviously satire, anaphora, the repetitions by the characters and by the author. That is amusing. The asides make it amusing. The comparisons, the similes, the metaphors make us laugh. The names of the people are funny, the lack of logic, the absurdities, and then the over-the-topness. Everything is really over-the-top. So, I'm going to do some quite unsurprising work and look at a completely different aspect of humour than many critics ignore. We've just looked at what we can regard as amusing or humorous in hard times. Where characters are taken so seriously, but we, the readers, laugh at them. What about the obverse, the opposite, the counterpart, the other side of this? What happens when characters regard themselves as funny, when they mock others, when they try to get others to laugh, but we, the reader, are actually horrified? What happens then? I know that, like me, many of you saw Lionel Bob's musical Oliver a long time ago, right? Fagin appeared quite funny and ever so musical, kind of humoring the situation, and a fellow be a villain on his line. Okay. The Artful Dodger was the light, full sight was scary. However, I can't remember quite the horror of the following scene you've got in a handout in front of you. You all have that, don't you? Let's look at the wit. We're looking at the sarcasm of our Chinese extract. We're looking at the teasing. Look at the language. It's humorous, but after having been rescued from a life of crime by Mr. Brownlow and staying with him, Oliver, dressed neatly and cleanly, is abducted off the street by Nancy and Bill Sykes and taken back to Fagin. What happens here? Oh, my wig! Cried Master Charles Bates from the side of the laughter and seated. Here he is! 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 I'll bear it! Such a jolly camera! With this irrepressible ebullition of mirth, Master Bates gave some fashion for, and kicked convulsively for 5 minutes in an ecstasy of facetious jogging. Then jumping to his feet, he snatched a cleft stick from his daughter and advanced to Oliver, beautiful round and round, while the Jew, taking off his nightcap, made a great number of low bows to the bewildered boy. The artful meantime was of a rather saturnine disposition, and seldom gave way to men and women to give business. Rifled Oliver's pockets with steady assiduity. Look, it is Charles Fagin, said Charlie, putting the light so close to his new jacket as he set on fire. Look, it is Charles, superfine claw, and the air is so cut. Oh my God, what a game! And it looks too, nothing but a gentleman, Fagin. Delighted to see you looking so well, my dear, said the Jew, bowing with mock humility. The artful shall give you another suit, my dear, for fear you should spoil that Sunday one. Why didn't you write, my dear, and say you were coming? We have got something warm for supper. At this, Master bent forward again, so loud that they were so relaxed, and even the daughter smiled. But as the artful grew forth, the 5 pound note that instant, it is doubtful whether the sally or the scurry awakened his merriment. Hello, sir! Inquired Sykes, stepping forward as the Jew sees the note. A smile, baby! No, no, my dear, said the Jew. Mind your mind. You should have the books. That ain't my little sucker, and he's tackled the chum there. My man's that is, I'll take the boy back again. The Jew started. Others started too, that were very good calls. We hope that the dispute might really end his behavior. Charlie, please, Moss. Father, I know that you never got well or whenever after this the other attractions came, both sides pursues him and actually wants to beat him to death. And that seems to be said. And it is a terrifying, terrifying scene. But that part isn't funny. Dickens actually has subverted humor here. What some characters find funny and amusing, others don't. The nasty can be funny, there is sort of humor, there's still a branch of comedy. But it gets darker and darker and more violent as we go on. I think that this is Dickens' warning to us that humor for some can be horror for others. So this is humour with a terrible possible consequence. He said, don't always trust the amusing. Don't trust the insincere. Look beyond what is humorous. Humour isn't always what makes us, the reader, laugh. It's what makes characters laugh as well. And then characters we despise. And when they laugh at someone we sympathise with, we get upset. But it's still humour, even if it is sick humor. And now, to quote Monty Python's Flying Circus, now for something. Indeed, now for something completely different. Let's get on to something truly humorous. The Pickwick Papers, the posthumous papers of the Pickwick Club. Okay, in short, the Pickwick Club was formed by Samuel Pickwick Esquire. The novel's main character, who is kind and wealthy and advanced in years. His intention is to investigate life in places possibly remote from London, in about 30 miles away. Other members are, these are wonderful names, Nathaniel Winkle, who sees himself as a sportsman, but like Absalom in the tale, doesn't know the end of a gun from the end of a horse. Tracy Tuckman, who is obese and elderly, but considers himself a romantic lover. Bit of tucking here, bit of tucking there. And Augustus Snodgrass, the famous poet who's never written any poetry. We also need Sam Weller, Pickwick Salad, who is a cockney, who at odd times give advice, and sometimes very odd advice. One of my favourite incidents comes in chapter 15. It is one of the less famous ones, and that's why I wanted to do it here. And it's very difficult within hard times. Dickens loved reading from his works on lecture tours, especially in America. Be they excerpts tense, or violent, or satirical, or political, or hilarious. One of the many reasons why this worked was it became a shared experience. Everyone hearing the text together without necessarily having to read it by themselves. I think that Dickens very often needs to be heard as well as read quietly. Maybe not in something like A Tale of Two Cities, but it looks very good in the movie, but A Tale of Two Cities, but certainly needs to be heard in the Pickwick Papers. I'm going to read some of it and interrupt myself as we go along. It's going to be a long extract. When I'm reading it, look at the language of the characters, or listen to the language. Their different accents are important, the different voices. Mockery here, mockery by Sam Weller, but more important, mockery by Charles Dickens, of one of the characters. Flattery. We see through the flattery, Pickwick doesn't. The emphasis on the words that Mr. Leo Hunter uses. The, again, anathema, repetitions of structure and of certain words that he or her uses. This all adds to humor. His pretentiousness, how he referred to his wife, the poem itself, the title and the recitation, and again, how over the top this is. Personal writing, said Sackett grammatically. Does the person want to meet, sir? Inquired Mr. Pickwick. He wants you in particular, and no one else will do, as the devil's private secretary said when he first joined Dr. Faustus, replied Mr. Weller. He? Is it a gentleman? Said Mr. Pickwick. A very good imitation of one, if I ain't, replied Mr. Weller. But this is a lady's card, said Mr. Pickwick. Given me by gentlemen, howsoever, replied Sam. And is awaiting the drawing room. Said he'd rather wait all day, not see you. Mr. Pickwick, on hearing this determination, descended to the drawing room where sat a grave man who started up in his entrance and said, a grave man. We know the word grave, it means solemn, serious, someone with dignity, but also someone who's rather self-important. Grave also refers to someone who's physically ponderous, who's dull. But a grave, another thing is a steward, is a steward, a person in charge of property, but he's obviously in charge of his wife's property, looks after her interests. But grave also means someone whose voice is low in pitch. This all ties up Oedipa. And I think Dickens is using every single meaning of Oedipa. So he said, with an air of profound respect, Mr. Pickwick, I presume the same. Allow me, sir, the honor of grasping your hand. Permit me, sir, to shake it, said the grave man. Certainly, said Mr. Pickwick. I don't know how many of you know the story about James Joyce, a famous Irish writer. He was at a function when his fame was at its height, and a woman ran up to him and said in these words, Mr. Joyce, permit me to shake the hand that wrote Ulysses. And he said, certainly not, madam. This hand has done many other things as well. You wouldn't want to shake it. The stranger shook his head and had him continue. We have heard of your fame, sir. The noise of your antiquarian discussion has reached the eyes of Mrs. Leo Hunter. My wife, sir. I am Mr. Leo Hunter. Emphasis Dickens. The stranger paused, as if he expected Mr. Pickwick would be overcome by the disclosure. But seeing that he remained perfectly calm, proceeded, my wife, sir, Mrs. Leo Hunter, is proud to number among her acquaintance all those who have rendered themselves celebrated by their works and talents. Permit me, sir, to place a conspicuous part of this, the name of Mr. Pickwick and his brother members of the club that derives its name from him. I shall be extremely happy to make the acquaintance of such a lady, said Mr. Pickwick. You shall make it, sir, said the great man. Tomorrow morning, sir, we give a public breakfast, a fête champêtre, to a great number of those who have rendered themselves celebrated by their works and talents. A fête champêtre is an outdoor festival, which it certainly isn't. Permit Mrs. Leo Hunter, sir, to have the gratification of seeing you at the den. great pleasure, replied Mr. Pickwick. Mrs. Neil Hunter has many of me breakfast, sir, resumed the acquaintance. Feast of reason, sir, and throne of soul. As somebody who wrote a sonnet to Mrs. Neil Hunter with breakfast, feelingly and originally observed. And then Pickwick and Hunter carry on talking, and Mr. Leo Hunter tells Pickwick how exceptionally talented his wife is, and somebody actually even said it. And says he believes that somebody in Mr. Pickwick's company writes poetry too. And Pickwick says, yes, my friend Mrs. Snodgrass has a great taste for poetry. So has Mrs. Neil Hunter, sir. She knows her poetry, sir. She adores it. I may say that her whole soul and mind are wound up and entwined with it. She has produced some delightful pieces herself, sir. You have met with her ode on an expiring frog, sir. I don't think that I have, said Mr. Pickwick. You're astonishing, sir, said Mr. Leo Hunter. It created an immense sensation. It was signed with an L. And 8 stars. And appeared originally in a ladies' magazine. Sorry. It commenced. Can I view the panting, lying on my stomach without sighing? Can I unmoved see me dying on a log, expiring frog? Beautiful, said Mr. Pickwick. Aye, said Mr. Leonardo. Very, said Mr. Pickwick. The next verse is somewhat touching. Shall I repeat it? If you please, said Mr. Pickwick. It runs thus, said the great man, somewhat gravely. Say, have feelings in shape of boys with wild halloo and brutal noise hunted thee from marshy joys. With a dog, expiring frog. So what is humorous here? The language of the characters and the characterization. The name Leo Hunter, Leo Lion that hunts. The contrast between civility, Pickwick trying to be decent, and the prophecies and pretentiousness of Leo Hunter. The absurdity of the poem, again the repetitions, again the over the top. And if you know the book in context, references to Mr. Snodgrass's poetry. To sum up, humour in both Hard Times and Pickwick Papers. Oliver Twist is a different kind of humour. The situations are rather bizarre. The language, again, is so important because of the wit, the cleverness of the use of language. Anaphora, repetition, time and time again. And we're going to see it tomorrow when we do the phenomenal Playboy of the Western World. The characterization always leads to humor in this case. The names again, Leo Hunter. The lack of self-knowledge. And the lack of self-knowledge, in other words, we know Gradgrind lacks self-knowledge. Leo Hunter. And we also find in the whole of Pickwick, Pickwick himself doesn't really know himself. They're not aware that they're making fools of themselves. And there's something that I call post facto dramatic irony. In other words, when we know the whole story and we come back to one of the earlier passages and we know what has happened, it makes what we read even finer. The mockery by the writer, if it is as good as this, exaggeration, the darkness, the satire of neoliberalism. We have satire of the education system. We have satire of one of the poets. And then, what is so important, each and every time, the context. Not only the context of the time about which this is written, but the context of our time as well. We can relate this to people we know, to situations we find ourselves in. And the context makes everything that much more human.